Part 1. Explaining Eliminationist Assaults. Chapter 3. Why They Begin. Why would people decide one day to slaughter other human beings by the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions? That someone might want to kill a person he knows, an avowed enemy, or a person who has done or explicitly threatens to do him or his loved ones injury, most people can comprehend. But that someone would wish to kill thousands or millions of people, including children, whom he has never met or seen, seems unfathomable. How could anyone want to do this? The seeming incomprehensibility of people consciously wanting so much death and suffering has led many to construct accounts that, in effect, deny that such desires exist or that they motivate mass murder. Such accounts focus not on the perpetrators, but on transnational systems such as capitalism or globalization, or social structures such as authoritative political systems or bureaucracies, or on trans-historical forces such as ethnic conflict or human nature. They make mass murder seem impersonal and inevitable, something beyond human control. Such accounts seem to make mass murder more comprehensible by glossing over the essential question, how could anyone want to do this? One such account is that mass murder is a consequence of nation-building, which is a complex political process that includes states consolidating and extending control over territory and forging in a heterogeneous society a dominant national identity. It often leads to the elimination of groups that do not fit the new nation through a combination of transformation, expulsion, and extermination. The Turks' annihilation of Armenians, the mass murders in various countries of post-colonial Africa, and others, and even the German slaughter of the Jews, have been attributed to nation-building. Yet, in reality, the relationship between nation-building, which often takes place over decades or longer, and mass slaughter is, at best, indirect and complicated, as we can see perhaps best from the history of the United States. Nation-building began during the American Revolution. Its central constructive moment was the adoption of the American Constitution in 1783. Tens of thousands of Tories, those opposing the new nation of a self-governing democracy, fled or were expelled. The former colonies, in a post-revolutionary compromise, produced a weak federal government with two incompatible political, social, economic, and moral systems, the Free North and the Slave South. These systems coexisted so uneasily that the South eventually contested the American state's legitimacy. The Civil War of 1861 to 1865, in which more Americans died than in any other war, was American nation-building's second great moment. In destroying the Southern system, it secured for the American state unchallenged authority. The third part of American nation-building was also violent. As the nation expanded westward and inward through and on to Native American lands, the American state and Americans sought Native Americans' general elimination from most of the country. Americans, overwhelmingly of European descent, reduced the Native American population with various policies that are sometimes hard to categorize because their effects were often indirect, if calculable. The absolute numbers of Native Americans whom Americans directly murdered is comparatively low, probably in the tens of thousands. Many more died from disease, which Americans, knowing their immunological vulnerability, sometimes purposely spread. Under government leadership or acquiescence, white Americans destroyed Native Americans' livelihood by taking their lands and killing the buffalo. Americans further eliminated Native Americans by herding them onto so-called reservations, institutionalizing a spatial and social apartheid, not of exploitation, but of neglect. The number of Native Americans on American soil declined from an estimated 10 million prior to the Europeans' discovery of the Americas, a number that would have since expanded substantially, to 2.4 million today. Not all, or maybe not even most, of those deaths resulted from explicit eliminationist policies and acts, but many did. These three principal aspects of American nation-building produced three different challenges to the American state and society. The presence of Tories would have undermined the fledgling republic. From the perspective of the victorious revolutionaries, Tories had to become loyal Americans or leave. The American state destroyed the Southern slave civilization in response to a fundamental challenge to power and the country's integrity. The Americans' systematic destruction of Native American life and lives, and their spatial elimination from American society, was an imperial conquest carried out by the state with the broad support of Americans. The violence of American nation-building exemplifies three major tasks that states and groups face during nation-building that produce insecurity, conflict, and bloodshed. Removing a foreign power and its loyalists, here the colonial British and the Tories, the political, social, or cultural homogenization of society, here destroying Southern slave civilization and the repression of its adherents, and the elimination of unwanted or putatively threatening groups, here annihilating, killing, and segregating Native Americans. American nation-building's most recent phase occurred in the 1960s and 1970s with the American South's desegregation, really the destruction of the Southern whites' post-Civil War, lesser eliminationist option of an apartheid system. This was accomplished without eliminationist violence. Nation-building is not a smooth process. It can proceed in alternating bursts of activity and quiescence. According to the ideals of those stewarding the national project, it typically remains incomplete, at least producing dissatisfactions and insecurities among those building the nation and those being squeezed into its image. Groups that lose out in this process are killed, leave the country, ordinarily they are expelled, or are socially transformed by having central aspects of their identity, culture, or practices denied, repressed, or destroyed. In responding to the paradigmatic challenges to them, Americans and their governments used the full range of these eliminationist means. They expelled, the Tories, transformed and homogenized, however partially, Southerners, and killed, expelled, and repressed Native Americans, peoples who did not seem to or want to fit in. There was also white Americans' eliminationist domination, killing, and repression of blacks, first by enslavement and then with apartheid. American nation-building and its mass eliminations bring to light critical themes for explaining the initiation of exterminationist and other eliminationist assaults. States and societies often face challenges, must deal with recalcitrant groups, and often face extreme ethnic conflict or resistance to plans of expansion. How do they respond to such challenges? When the elimination of recalcitrant groups is sought, is it principally the state or groups within society that initiate it? Why did American state and Americans respond to the three challenges of nation building with such different means and results? In each instance, the response's severity did not correspond to the challenge. The Southern states began the Civil War, resulting in 360,000 dead and an additional 275,000 wounded among the Union. However, even though the Union's armies laid waste to swaths of the South during the war, they did not systematically slaughter or expel Southern civilians. Native Americans never inflicted nearly as many casualties or destruction upon Americans as the Southerners did against the North. Yet Americans conducted thoroughgoing eliminationist campaigns against them, clearing entire regions of them, sometimes by slaughtering them, such as the almost total annihilation of the 10,000 Yuki of Northern California in the late 1850s. The Confederate Army's defeated military commander, Robert E. Lee, was permitted to retire with honor. Imagine his fate and the fate of his lieutenants and others had he been a Native American general who killed so many American soldiers and inflicted so much misery on the American people. With the Indian Removal Act of 1830, the American government enshrined the de facto expulsion of Native American tribes east of the Mississippi River in American law and political practice. Tories, British, white, and Christian, were treated with dignity, allowed to choose to take an oath to the new nation or leave for the old. Southerners, American, white, and Christian, were coerced into accepting the national order, and after a short period of occupation, were permitted to retake control of their own Southern society and to create brutal apartheid against blacks. Native Americans, not real Americans, dark-skinned and non-Christian, were deemed barbaric and threatening, so white Americans rendered them harmless by killing them or depositing them in camps, euphemistically called reservations, or assimilating those deemed assimilable, including by forcibly removing Native American children from their families and educating them in Western ways as a means of killing the Indian and saving the man. Why did Americans employ different eliminationist responses to different challenges? I imagine that when Americans reflect on each episode in isolation, the answer to the question, if people even see this as a question, seems obvious. But once the three episodes are seen in the light of the others and of other countries' eliminationist projects, the answers seem anything but self-evident. Nation-building in and of itself could not be the principal explanation for why mass murders or even eliminations are undertaken. After all, many Tories who had sided against the revolutionaries were allowed to join the new nation, and they chose to do so. Likewise, white Southerners, unlike their political system of slavery, were not eliminated, and the repression they suffered was lifted soon after the Civil War. Nation-building always faces challenges to its goals and always produces responses to them. But the responses are of different eliminationist means, or no eliminationist means at all, when nation-builders pursue, often successfully, political compromises. To understand the relationship between nation-building, or other structural or trans-historical forces, and eliminationist and exterminationist assaults, a perspective is needed that is more complex and multifaceted than one that asserts that nation-building, or anything else, causes mass murder. Four questions and three perspectives. Explaining the initiation of campaigns of mass elimination and annihilation begins with four questions. The first, most obvious one, is the staple of the general literature on mass murder. Why does the machinery of destruction get set in motion? The other three are generally not directly addressed, so their answers are assumed. Question two, why do some groups get targeted for elimination and others, even others in the same country, do not? Question 3. When a group is slated for elimination, why is the annihilationist variant chosen? Question 4. Why does the annihilationist assault begin when it does and not earlier or later? Relevant to these four questions and to explaining mass murder is the issue of determinism. Are episodes of mass annihilation inevitable? Once certain conditions are created, such as a nation-building project, acute ethnic conflict, or intensive prejudice and persecution against a group, is the path to mass extermination unavoidable? This question has been posed most famously for the Holocaust, with some people treating it as having been inevitable. Perspectives on mass annihilation generally take deterministic positions or have a strong deterministic bent. Many general perspectives exist about why mass murders begin, which, of the four questions discussed above, is the question this chapter focuses on. Yet whatever these perspectives' substantial differences, each locates mass murder's source principally in one of three places: the character of the state, the composition of society including its culture, or the psychology of the individual. Each of these perspectives captures important elements of the entire complex, yet each taken on its own is inadequate. State-centered perspectives correctly observe that annihilationist campaigns are quintessentially political acts that are almost always started by states, or entities vying to be states. Therefore, mass murder's causes are to be found in the nature of states. Most commonly, state instability is held responsible. Weak and threatened states react by annihilating those perceived as an actual or potential threat. This sort of thinking is a political analog to the analytical dodge and crutch of the endlessly invented and reified human nature. It's just in the nature of states. Nation building, the decline of empires, war, and today, globalization, are frequently said to cause such state instability and consequences. Proponents of this state-centered perspective routinely cite post-colonial states in Africa, as well as tottering countries such as Turkey during World War I, which was both an empire in decline and a state engaged in nation-building, and Germany during the Nazi period. A different state-centered view holds the opposite, that it is great power that leads states to slaughter people. States that completely dominate their societies, states that are not restrained by internal checks and by a vibrant civil society, are able to kill people standing in their way or deemed superfluous. So they do. The colossal mass murders of Nazi Germany, the Soviet Union, Communist China, and Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge are adduced as evidence that although power kills, great power kills even more. A second perspective about the initiation of mass annihilation focuses on a country's social and ethnic composition. Where ethnic conflict is acute over power or economic benefits, or where competing mutually exclusive ethnic, religious, or linguistic visions rend a society, groups seek to exterminate their enemies. Society-centered perspectives are typically proffered for poor countries, often former colonies, composed of antagonistic ethnic groups that colonial powers threw together. The political and economic spoils are so meager that deadly struggle ensues. Kill or be killed, or so it seems to the protagonists. Society-centered perspectives sometimes focus less on the country's social composition and more on its dominant culture. When a culture of dehumanization removes a group from the family of humanity and therefore from the moral order, mass murder results. In this view, acute ethnic or religious conflict may produce such dehumanization, which then induces its bearers to kill. Individual-centered perspectives for the initiation of mass annihilation locate mass murder in the psychological mechanisms of the individual that impel people to slaughter others. One aforementioned view, typically not articulated, underlies many analyses. When the opportunity to annihilate others presents itself, the will to power, the beast within us, leads people to kill the people they see as enemies or obstacles. The view that unfettered state power allows and therefore impels states to kill relies implicitly on this notion. Variants of the individual-centered perspective propose a range of psychological mechanisms that cause people to feel mortally threatened, that remove inhibitions against killing, or that lead people to vent aggression lethally, which alone or in combination produces mass annihilation. Abundant approaches and notions seek to account for why mass murders begin. They work at different levels of analysis, political, societal, and individual, and select cases for discussion that seem to substantiate the given view, with each one finding credence for two additional reasons. First, analyzing mass annihilation is difficult. This is also true of the all but ignored mass elimination. Much goes into producing mass murder, so the events and factors to be accounted for are complex. Yet our knowledge of most mass murders is spotty and unreliable, so the empirical foundation is insufficient for deriving robust conclusions. Accounting for such a complex phenomenon with poor data makes simplification and focusing on only one level of analysis tempting. This leads to the proliferation of views capturing one or another of mass murder's aspects while failing to account for the phenomenon writ large. Second, because mass murder is complex, as are the concepts used to analyze it, defining or redefining a state or a society in a manner that accords with a favored approach is easy. For example, Germany during the Nazi period is said to have been the wellspring of mass murder because of state weakness, the loss of World War I, followed by the disaster of the Weimar Republic, followed by the garrison-like situation of Nazism, and because of enormous state power. The mass murder was initiated supposedly because of the euphoria of military victory and because of the despair of impending defeat. The Germans decided to kill Jews because of the Jews' unusual economic and cultural success in Germany, and because of long-standing prejudice, anti-Semitism, that was independent of the Jews' economic and cultural lives. Often the concepts used are so woolly they can be stretched to accommodate almost any reality, becoming analytically meaningless. Nation building is a prime example. When one group seeks to eliminate another, it is easy to declare it an expression of nation building, particularly because perpetrators typically invoke their nation or people to justify their deeds, heighten group conflict, and mobilize support among their compatriots. A proponent of the nation-building view can almost always see a mass murder in this light. It is not surprising that the Jews' mass murder by Germans, the delayed nation, as their country has often been called, has also been accounted for in this way. These general propositions about state, society, and the individual can still be assessed in light of the four questions, and in light of the evidence that, though imperfect, suggests which conclusions are valid. In doing so, we should keep in mind that each proposition, whatever its virtues, either overdetermines, suggests that mass murder is inevitable, or underdetermines, fails to account for the specific aspects of mass murder's beginning, what it purports to explain. State-centered views correctly identify the state as mass annihilation's prime mover. But claims about why states move to kill people, nation building's challenges, war's stress, totalitarian domination's unchecked power, fail to account for why many similarly positioned states do not initiate mass murder. State-centered views also cannot tell us why states kill certain groups and not others. Nazi Germany systematically killed mentally ill people and Sinti and Roma, but the Soviet Union did not. Nor can such views explain why states choose to kill some groups, yet eliminate others using different means, nor the timing of the killing. They cannot account for the possibility, which historically has in fact frequently occurred, that the causality is reversed, that eliminationist desires produce the nation-building project, lead to war, or create the wish for total power. These views' greatest failing, perhaps, is to explain the origin of the motive to annihilate or eliminate people. The structural condition, whether it be perceived weakness or great power, does not self-evidently generate motives of any kind to act, and certainly not according to some ironclad cause and effect rule. Most obvious, they do not generate the motive to destroy or otherwise eliminate specific groups and to kill their children, groups that manifestly have little or nothing to do with state conditions, such as people deemed mentally ill, Sinti and Roma, or Jews. State-centered perspectives present the generation of the motive to kill as being precisely what it is not, self-evident or somehow imminent in the condition of power. They treat mass murder as being determined, and they fail to account for the variability and uncertainty of its initiation and of the eliminationist programs themselves. Society-centered perspectives identify the source of an animus that can motivate people to annihilate others. Ethnic conflict or great prejudice can produce the desire and a justification for slaughtering others. But society-centered perspectives otherwise suffer failings similar to state-centered views. They cannot explain why some ethnic conflicts or prejudices produce systematic mass murder, whereas others do not, such as in the American South against blacks, in South Africa against blacks and then against whites, in Western European countries against Muslims, or in most countries past and present. Societal accounts cannot explain the mass murder of groups that are not the object of intensive social conflict or cultural prejudice, including the victims of communist regimes. And they cannot explain the timing of mass murder, of, for example, the various phases of the Germans' eliminationist program against the Jews, or of their various assaults on their other targeted groups. Society-centered views also rely on the disqualifying assumption that intensive social conflict or prejudice will reflexively provide the impetus for a state program of mass annihilation, and that the state's character, the regime type, the leader's character, etc., is of little or no causal importance, because the state, as an obedient servant, is a conveyor belt for powerful social groups' murderous desires. Individual-centered views may reveal something about what moves certain individuals in the destructive process, but they do not address mass annihilation's broader political and social contexts. They tend to treat people as universal abstractions, having the same psychological properties and reaction to external stimuli. They, like the state and society-centered perspectives, cannot explain why similar conditions only sometimes produce mass murder, why only some hated groups are targeted, or the timing of the killing. By privileging one arena, the political, the social, or the individual, each of these views misses much that is essential to initiating mass murder. Each depends upon a causal chain that assumes steps that need explanation, as do existing analyses that point to a confluence of causal factors. Each has a deterministic bent to it, having not unequivocally rejected the notion that certain factors determine the perpetration of mass murder. And each could not possibly provide the explanation for why mass murder begins, because none specifies the mechanism that unleashes it. Whatever other factors may be present, whatever other events may occur, whatever other acts may be taken, mass killing and elimination's initiation consists of a discrete act that takes place at an identifiable moment. The many existing accounts do not explain why mass annihilation is undertaken at the time that it is, even though this act is, compared to much in the social and political world, relatively simple and straightforward. This suggests that the act of initiating mass murder does not lend itself to a systematic, causal explanation. If it did, we would know it. A new perspective. Explaining the initiation of mass murder and eliminations requires that we recognize that certain conditions or factors of state or society create the opportunities and increase the probability a mass annihilation or elimination will be set in motion. But none of these conditions, singly or in combination, inexorably produces such assaults. We must accept that different paths lead to mass murder, and that the patterns that exist are partial. We must treat politics as central in the genesis of mass murder. We must specify the source and character of people's motivation to slaughter others. Perhaps most important, we must acknowledge that only one or a few people initiate a mass annihilation or elimination. As I adopted in Hitler's Willing Executioners an explicitly multi-level and multifaceted approach with different causal components for the different aspects, state initiation, implementation, source of motivation, etc., of mass murder and elimination, as the only way to explain the Holocaust's perpetration, it became clear to me that the same is necessary for understanding eliminationist and exterminationist politics in general. Regarding the initiation of mass murder, I wrote, analyzing in detail the evolution of Adolf Hitler's eliminationist thinking about Jews into a total annihilation policy, The most virulent hatred, whether it be anti-Semitism or some other form of racism or prejudice, does not result in systematic slaughter unless political leaders mobilize and organize those who hate into a program of killing. This means that at some point, one or a few people consciously, willfully, and with full capacity to do otherwise, decide to slaughter other human beings by the thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions, or to eliminate them in another way. This decision-making moment is not reducible to or determined by other factors. It is generated by the will to kill, and also the forge for translating that will into a firm resolve to perpetrate the act. It is, therefore, the self-sufficient account for why these people perpetrate mass murder and elimination. The Central Committee of the Turkish Committee of Union and Progress, the political party ruling Turkey, decided to eliminate, mainly to exterminate, the Armenians probably in March 1915, after, according to one of its members, long and in-depth discussions. The Central Committee's leaders were Mehmet Talat and Ismail Enver, whose stewardship and approval of the eliminationist assault they repeatedly affirmed in Turkish documents and in discussions with foreign diplomats, including with American Ambassador Henry Morgenthau, who has copiously related the rather candid discussions they had with him about their desire to annihilate the Armenians, as they responded to his objections and arguments that they desist. The Turkish leaders opted, as part of their political remaking of Turkey, to finally solve what they and many Turks and the previous Ottoman regime considered an acute political problem, the existence of this substantial non-Turkic minority within an ever more aggressively Turkic Turkey. The Armenians' position had been a theme in Turkey's politics and life for decades, resulting in previous eliminationist and exterminationist assaults. Now, under the cover of war, Talat and Enver, with the other Central Committee leaders, finally decided decisively. Talat, in a letter dated May 26, 1915, announced to the head of parliament, known as the Grand Vizier, that deportations must begin so that Turkey could eliminate its Armenian problem. This leadership decision was coolly calculated. Talat explains, "Preparations and presentations have been proposed and considered for a final end in a comprehensive and absolute way to this issue, which constitutes an important matter among the vital issues for the state." He further informed Morgenthau that the Union and Progress Committee had carefully considered the matter in all its details and that the policy which was being pursued was that which they had officially adopted. He said that I must not get the idea that the deportations had been decided upon hastily. In reality, they were the result of prolonged and careful deliberation. German Consul General Johann Mortmann reported on June 30 that Talat had instructed him a few weeks earlier that what we are talking about is the elimination of Armenians. Hitler both created general eliminationist and exterminationist policy orientation and took the decisions for individual programs. Shortly after assuming power, he issued the Law for the Prevention of Offspring with Hereditary Diseases, mandating the compulsory sterilization of Germans suffering from a hereditary disease, including feeble-mindedness, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, epilepsy, Huntington's chorea, blindness, deafness, physical deformities, and alcoholism, if they were deemed hereditary. This first of the Germans' formal mass elimination programs destroyed more than 300,000 people's reproductive capacities. Hitler authorized the camp system's creation around the same time. Hitler, holding sterilization to be a second-best eliminationist means for the mentally ill and developmentally disabled, ordered in 1939 that such children and adults be systematically exterminated in a euthanasia program. He created the general contours for the Eastern conquered territory's murderous subjugation, starting with Poland, in preparation for which he infamously declared that no one any longer spoke about the Armenians. And Hitler made the critical decisions to move policy forward in every stage of the eliminationist assault against the Jews, culminating in spring 1941 with his decision for systematic mass murder during the coming assault on the Soviet Union and its Jews. Shortly after the Khmer Rouge took power, Pol Pot presided over a 5-day meeting of its military and civilian leaders. He personally enunciated his transformative and eliminationist program's central contours. His second-in-command, Nunchia, elaborated on the program's and procedure's details. 5 people have testified, 3 were present, 2 received accounts from their superiors who had been there, with general consistency about Pol Pot's orders for the eliminationist expulsion of people from cities and towns, the expulsion from Cambodia of all ethnic Vietnamese, and the establishment of the camp system called cooperatives. One participant explains, "It was Pol Pot who distributed this plan personally." Pol Pot declared, "Don't use money. Don't let people live in the cities." He specifically singled out one group. Monks, they said, were to be disbanded, put aside as a special class, the most important to fight. They had to be wiped out. I heard Pol Pot say this myself. A third participant describes Nunchia delivering the general killing order. "In order to achieve the construction of socialism progressively and advance altogether in the set period, we must take care to carefully screen internal agents in the party, in the armed forces, in the various organizations and ministries, in the government, and among the masses of the people." "We have to carefully screen them," Nunchia said. He mentioned the line of carefully screening internal agents to improve and purify in order to implement the line of building socialism. "This was a very important order to kill. Their careful screening was to take all measures so that people were pure. The line laid down must be followed at all costs. If people could not do it, they would be taken away and killed. This was called the line of careful screening. The words, carefully screen, were the killing principle and were stated strongly on 20 May. It was to be done." In Ethiopia, the Derg's mass murdering and regional expulsion program was leader Mengistu Haile Mariam's brainchild. Dawit Walda Georgis, the commissioner of the euphemistic Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, the institution that was to carry out the deportations, relates its inception. "In the beginning of October 1984, Mengistu called me into his office. He told me out of the blue that he was planning a massive national resettlement campaign. He planned to move 300,000 families, 1.5 million people, from Wallo and Tigray to southwestern Ethiopia in 9 months. I was amazed at these numbers. He said that this was the opportune moment to implement this project, which he claimed to have been considering for a long time, since the people couldn't refuse. They were helpless." Dawit then describes Mengistu's rationale, which Mengistu emphasized was tied to his political transformative objectives, including using the target areas as places for politically undesirable people and to depopulate rebel areas in order to deprive the guerrillas of support. Dawit continues, "It was one of those rare moments when he becomes relatively frank and one gets a glimpse of the real Mengistu. I told him that it would be a fatal mistake to attempt to settle 300,000 families in 9 months. He refused to see my points. He said that he would support my agency with the necessary manpower and financial backing. He argued that the RRC could mobilize international support. I was instructed to draw up a tentative operational plan. Mengistu was overflowing with enthusiasm as he told me all this. It was clear that he considered this project to be the panacea for all the ills of the country. Mengistu loves campaigns, and this was something he could sink his teeth into. Initiating mass murder and elimination is a quintessential act of human agency, of choice. This act is typically accompanied by the total conviction with which Talet and Enver faced down Morgenthau, Hitler so often openly demonstrated when speaking about the need for and then coming extermination of the Jews, that Joseph Stalin was known for, that Nguyen Chia conveyed, Pol Pot was reserved, that Mengistu demonstrated, and that political Islamists, including Osama bin Laden, regularly parade. It is sometimes, for all we know, often, accompanied by the kind of enthusiasm that Dawit describes Mengistu displaying as he, like other eliminationist dreamers and perpetrators, contemplated this panacea for all the ills of the country. Anyone who asserts that the initiation of violent and lethal eliminations is determined by structures or forces simply overlooks the facts of the orders and the meetings in which they were promulgated, the facts of the many other orders and meetings in which they were not, and the facts of decision after decision to initiate or not to initiate one exterminationist and eliminationist program after another. There is no mass murder or elimination I know that could not have been avoided had one person or a few people decided to do otherwise, which they easily could have done. There is no mass murder or elimination that could not have been avoided had other people held power. This means that the worldviews, aspirations, and moral framework, the prejudices and hatreds, and the personalities of the person or small group of people who make the eliminationist decision are crucial. These specific individuals, their ideas and personalities, require investigation. A general framework for answering the basic questions about the initiation of mass annihilations and eliminations, why they begin, why only some groups get targeted, why certain means are chosen, and why they begin when they do, starts with the conditions that first generate the idea that mass killing or elimination may be desirable, and the conditions that then make it practical, namely thinkable as a policy. Many societies contain groups that others hate or think dangerous and would therefore like to eliminate. Why then do the eliminationist views around the world get transformed into actual annihilation or elimination against some of them, actually only a small percentage of such groups, but not others? War, nation-building conflicts, extreme challenges to the state or national integrity, and intense ethnic strife increase the likelihood that eliminationist sentiment will be inflamed, brought into politics, and turned into policy, including lethal policy. They create conditions that make eliminationist, even annihilationist politics more thinkable and more practicable, but never certain or even likely. Just as the war made the Germans' annihilation of the mentally ill, the Jews, and the Sinti and Roma feasible, but did not lead Germany's conquerors to annihilate Germans. Just as American nation-building led to the eliminationist policies against Native Americans, but did not produce similar policies toward others threatening the national project, so too do challenges to the state and intense ethnic conflict sometimes provide the context for merciless annihilation and eliminations, and at other times do no such thing. South Africa is an example of an intense conflict that produced protracted violence, but not mass annihilation by either whites or blacks against the other. For decades, mutually incompatible visions of the nation and politics, ethnic conflict between blacks and whites, and military and civil fighting between the African National Congress and the white apartheid state dominated the country. Yet these overlapping and reinforcing conflicts never resulted in the whites annihilating those they believed would destroy their society and perhaps themselves. These conflicts and all that blacks had suffered also did not lead the African National Congress and blacks, upon taking power, to annihilate whites or even the apartheidists, as many had feared. Few countries have had more long-lasting and intensive domestic conflicts than South Africa. According to most perspectives on mass annihilation, South Africa should have suffered one mass murder campaign, if not successive or reciprocal campaigns. South Africa's history during and after its apartheid years resoundingly belies structural or deterministic theories of mass murder. Various circumstances facilitate people's choosing a path leading to mass murder or elimination, but political leaders are compelled neither to choose that path nor to reach its end. Whatever a country's stresses, whatever the real or imagined threats, however intensive its ethnic conflicts, if political leaders do not enact an exterminationist or eliminationist program, then mass murder, expulsion, and incarceration do not occur. The critical factor is the political leaders. Some move states or groups to commit mass murder. Others, where mass murder would be possible, do not.